Reaching the top. I haven't told you yet about the best and worst thing that ever happened to me professionally. I made it to the end of the baseball rainbow, the World Series. I was only 23. The Pirates' backup catcher broke his ankle in early September, and they needed a replacement, so I was called up. I still remember the day I walked into that carpeted locker room. I couldn't believe the size of it. I called Catherine from a payphone. We'd been married for 6 months. And I kept repeating, "It's unbelievable." A few weeks later, the Pirates won the pennant. It would be a lie to say I was in any way responsible. They were in first place when I arrived. I did catch 4 innings in one playoff game, and in my second at bat, I smacked a ball to deep right field. It was caught, and I was out. But I remember thinking, "That's a start. I can hit this stuff." It wasn't a start. Not for me. We reached the World Series, but were beaten in 5 games by the Baltimore Orioles. I never even got to bat. The last game was a 5-0 defeat, and after the final out, I stood on the dugout steps and watched the Baltimore players run onto the field and celebrate, throwing themselves into a giant pile by the pitcher's mound. To others, they looked ecstatic, but to me, they looked relieved, like the pressure was finally off. I never saw that look again, but I still dream about it sometimes. I see myself in that pile. Had the Pirates won the championship, there would have been a parade in Pittsburgh. Instead, because we lost on the road, we went to a Baltimore bar and closed it down. Defeat had to be washed away by booze in those days, and we washed ours away thoroughly. As the newest guy on the team, I mostly listened to the older players grumble. I drank what I was supposed to drink. I cursed when they all cursed. It was dawn when we staggered out of that place. We flew home a few hours later. In those days, everyone flew commercial, and most of us took hangover naps. They had taxis lined up for us at the airport. We shook hands. We said, "See you next year." The doors shut in one cab after another. Thump, thump, thump. The following March in spring training, I blew out my knee. I was sliding into third base and my foot jammed, and the fielder tripped over me, and I felt a snap like I'd never felt before. The doctor said I tore the anterior, posterior, and medial collateral ligaments, the trifecta of knee injuries. In time, I healed. I resumed playing baseball. But for the next 6 years, I never came close to the major leagues again, no matter how hard I tried, no matter how well I thought I was doing. It was as if the magic had washed off of me. The only evidence I had of my time in the big leagues were the newspaper box scores from 1973 and my baseball card, with a photo of me holding a bat, looking serious, my name in black letters, the smell of bubblegum permanently attached. The company shipped me 2 boxes of those cards. I sent one box to my father. I kept the other. They call a short stay in baseball a cup of coffee, and that's what I had. But it was a cup of coffee at the best table in the best joint in town. Which, of course, was good and bad. You see, I was more alive in those 6 weeks with the Pirates than I ever felt before or since. The spotlight had made me feel immortal. I missed the huge carpeted locker room. I missed walking through airports with my teammates, feeling the eyes of the fans as we passed. I missed the crowds in those big stadiums, the flashbulbs, the roaring cheers, the majesty of the whole thing. I missed it bitterly. So did my father. We shared a thirst to return, unspoken, undeniable. And so I clung to baseball long after I should have quit. I went from minor league city to minor league city, still believing, as athletes often do, that I would be the first to defy the aging process. I dragged Catherine with me all over the country. We had apartments in Portland, Jacksonville, Albuquerque, Fayetteville, and Omaha. During her pregnancy, she had 3 different doctors. In the end, Maria was born in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, 2 hours after a game attended by maybe 80 people, before rain sent them scattering. I had to wait for a cab to get to the hospital. I was almost as wet as my daughter when she came into the world. I quit baseball not long after that. And nothing I tried ever came close. I attempted my own business, which only lost me money. I looked around for coaching positions, but couldn't find any. In the end, a guy offered me a job in sales. His company made plastic bottles for food and pharmaceuticals, and I took it. The work was dull, the hours were tedious. Even worse, I only got the job because they figured I could tell baseball stories, and maybe close a deal in the frothy hubris of men talking sports. It's funny, I met a man once who did a lot of mountain climbing. I asked him which was harder, ascending or descending. He said, without a doubt, descending, because ascending you were so focused on reaching the top, you avoided mistakes. The backside of a mountain is a fight against human nature, he said. You have to care as much about yourself on the way down as you did on the way up. I could spend a lot of time talking about my life after baseball, but that pretty much says it. Not surprisingly, my father faded with my athletic career. Oh, he came to see the baby a few times, but he was not as fascinated by a grandchild as I hoped he would be. As time passed, we had less and less to talk about. He sold his liquor stores and bought a half interest in a distributorship, which more than paid his bills without requiring much attendance. It's funny, even though I needed a job, he never once offered one. I guess he'd spent too much time molding me to be different, to allow me to be the same. It wouldn't have mattered. Baseball was our common country, and without it, we drifted like two boats with the oars pulled in. He bought a condo in a suburb of Pittsburgh, joined a golf club, developed a mild form of diabetes, and had to watch his diet and give himself shots. And just as effortlessly as he had surfaced beneath those gray college skies, so did my old man slide back into foggy absentia, the occasional phone call, the Christmas card. You might ask if he ever explained what happened between him and my mother. He didn't. He simply said, it didn't work out between us. If I pressed him, he would add, you wouldn't understand. The worst he ever said about my mother was, she's a hard-headed woman. It was as if they had made this pact to never speak about what drove them apart. But I asked them both the question, and only my father lowered his eyes when he answered. The second visit ends. Posey, Miss Thelma whispered, I'm going to visit with my grandchildren for a spell. She looked much better than when she'd rung the bell at my mother's house. Her face was smooth and her eyes and lips were done nicely. My mother had brushed out her dyed orange tresses, and for the first time I realized Miss Thelma was an attractive woman and must have been a knockout when she was young. My mother laid a kiss on Miss Thelma's cheek, then closed her bag and motioned for me to follow. We stepped into the hallway, where a little girl with her hair in braids was headed toward us, clomping her feet. Grandma, she said, are you awake? I stepped back, but she walked right past us, never looking up. She was followed by a little boy, maybe her brother, who stopped in the doorway and put a finger in his mouth. I reached out and waved a hand before his face. Nothing. It was clear we were invisible to them. Mom, I stammered, what's going on? She was looking at Miss Thelma, whose granddaughter was now on the bed. They were playing some kind of patty cake. My mother had tears in her eyes. Is Miss Thelma dying too? I asked. Soon, my mother said. I stepped in front of her. Mom, please. She called for me, Charlie. We both looked toward the bed. Miss Thelma, she summoned you? No, sweetheart. I came to her mind, that's all. I was a thought. She wished I was still around and could help her look pretty, not as sick. So here I was. A thought? I looked down. I'm lost. My mother moved closer, her voice softened. Have you ever dreamt of someone who's gone, Charlie? But in the dream, you have a new conversation. The world you enter then is not so far from the world I'm in now. She put one hand on mine. When someone is in your heart, they're never really gone. They can come back to you, even at unlikely times. On the bed, the little girl played with Miss Thelma's hair. Miss Thelma grinned and glanced over at us. Do you remember the old lady Galinsky? My mother said. I remembered. A patient at the hospital. Terminal illness. She was dying. But she used to tell my mother every day about people who visited her. People from her past with whom she spoke and laughed. My mother recounted this at the dinner table, how she'd peek in the room and see the old lady Galinsky with her eyes closed, smiling and mumbling in some invisible conversation. My father called her crazy. She died a week later. She wasn't crazy, my mother said now. Then Miss Thelma is close. My mother's eyes narrowed. It's easier to talk to the dead the closer you get. I felt a cold flush from my shoulders to my feet. Does that mean I'm... I meant to say dying. I meant to say gone. You're my son, she whispered. That's what you are. I swallowed. How much time do I have? Some, she said. Not a lot. What's a lot? I don't know, Mom. Will I be with you forever, or will you be gone in a minute? You can find something truly important in a minute, she said. Suddenly, all the glass in Miss Thelma's house exploded. Windows, mirrors, TV screens. The shattering pieces flew around us as if we stood in the vortex of a hurricane. A voice from outside thundered over it all. Charles Bonetto, I know you can hear me. Answer me. What do? I screamed to my mother. She blinked calmly as the glass swirled around her. That's up to you, Charlie, she said. Part 4, Night. The sunlight fades. Once heaven is done with Grandma, we'd like her back, thanks. My daughter had written that in the guest book at my mother's funeral, the kind of assumptive yet incongruent thing a teenager comes up with. But seeing my mother again, hearing her explain how this dead world worked, how she was called back to people by their memories of her, well, maybe Maria was onto something. The glass storm of Miss Thelma's house had passed. I'd had to squeeze my eyes shut to make it stop. Shards of glass poked in my skin, and I tried to brush them free, but even that seemed to require great effort. I was weakening, withering. This day with my mother was losing its light. Am I going to die? I asked. I don't know, Charlie. Only God knows that. Is this heaven? This is Pepperville Beach, don't you remember? If I'm dead, if I die, do I get to be with you? She grinned. Oh, so now you want to be with me. Maybe that sounds cold to you, but my mother was just being my mother, a little funny, a little teasing, the way she'd be had we spent this day together before she died. She was also justified. So many times I had chosen not to be with her. Too busy, too tired, don't feel like dealing with it. Church? No thanks. Dinner? Sorry. Come down to visit? Can't do it, maybe next week. You count the hours you could have spent with your mother. It's a lifetime in itself. She took my hand now. After Miss Thelma's, we simply walked forward and the scenery changed, and we eased through a series of brief appearances in people's lives. Some I recognized as my mother's old friends. Some were men I barely knew, men who had once admired her, a butcher named Armando, a tax attorney named Howard, a flat-nosed watch repairman named Gerhard. My mother spent only a moment with each, smiling or sitting in front of them. So they're thinking about you now, I said. She said, nodding. You go everywhere you're thought of? No, she said, not everywhere. We appeared near a man gazing out a window, then another man in a hospital bed. So many, I said. They were just men, Charlie, decent men. Some were widowers. Did you go out with them? No. Did they ask? Many times. Why are you seeing them now? Oh, a woman's prerogative, I guess. She placed her hands together and touched her nose, hiding a small smile. It's still nice to be thought about, you know. I studied her face. There was no doubting her beauty, even in her late 70s, when she had taken on a more wrinkled elegance, her eyes behind glasses, her hair, once the blue-black of midnight, now the silver of a cloudy afternoon sky. These men had seen her as a woman, but I had never seen her that way. I had never known her as Pauline, the name her parents had given her, or as Posy, the name her friends had given her, only as Mom, the name I had given her. I could only see her carrying dinner to the table with kitchen mitts, or carpooling us to the bowling alley. Why didn't you marry again? I asked. Charlie. She narrowed her eyes. Come on. No, I'm serious. After we grew up, weren't you lonely? She looked away. Sometimes. But then you and Roberta had kids, and that gave me grandkids. And I had the ladies here, and, oh, you know, Charlie, the years pass. I watched her turn her palms up and smile. I had forgotten the small joy of listening to my mother talk about herself. Life goes quickly, doesn't it, Charlie? Yeah. I mumbled. It's such a shame to waste time. We always think we have so much of it. I thought about the days I had handed over to a bottle, the nights I couldn't remember, the mornings I slept through, all those hours spent running from myself. "Do you remember," she started laughing, "when I dressed you as a mummy for Halloween and it rained?" I looked down. "You ruined my life." Even then, I thought, blaming someone else. "You should eat some supper," she said. And with that, we were back in her kitchen at the round table one last time. There was fried chicken and yellow rice and roasted eggplant, all hot, all familiar, dishes she'd cooked for my sister and me 100 times. But unlike the stunned sensation I'd felt earlier in this room, now I was agitated, unnerved, as if I knew something bad was coming. She glanced at me concerned, and I tried to deflect her attention. "Tell me about your family," I said. "Charlie," she said, "I've told you that stuff." My head was pounding. "Tell me again." And so she did. She told me about her parents, both immigrants, who died before I was born. She told me about her 2 uncles and her crazy aunt who refused to learn English and still believed in family curses. She told me about her cousins, Joe and Eddie, who lived on the other coast. There was usually one small anecdote that identified each person. She was deathly afraid of dogs. He tried to join the Navy when he was 15. And it seemed critical now that I matched the name with the detail. Roberta and I used to roll our eyes when she launched into these stories, but years later, after the funeral, Maria had asked me questions about the family, who was related to whom, and I struggled. I couldn't remember. A big chunk of our history had been buried with my mother. You should never let your past disappear that way. So this time I listened, intently, as my mother went through each branch of the tree, bending back a finger for every person she recounted. Finally, when she finished, she pushed her hands together, and the fingers, like the characters, intertwined. "Anyhow," she half sang, "that was, I missed you, Mom." The words just spilled out of me. She smiled, but she didn't answer. She seemed to consider the sentence, gathering my intent as if pulling in a fisherman's net. Then, with the sun setting into whatever horizon of whatever world we were in, she ticked her tongue and said, "We have one more stop to make, Charlie." The day he wanted back. I need to tell you now about the last time I saw my mother alive and the thing that I did. It was 8 years earlier, at her 79th birthday party. She had joked that people had better come, because starting next year, I'm not going to tell anyone it's my birthday ever again. Of course, she said this at 69 and 59 and maybe even 29. The party was a lunch at her house on a Saturday afternoon. In attendance were my wife and my daughter, my sister Roberta and her husband Elliot, their 3 kids, the youngest of which 5-year-old Roxanne now wore ballerina slippers wherever she went, plus a good 2 dozen people from the old neighborhood, including the elderly women whose hair my mother washed and set. Many of these women were in poor health. One came in a wheelchair. Still, they had all been recently coiffed, their hair sprayed like helmets, and I wondered if my mother hadn't organized the party just so the ladies had a reason to primp. "I want Grandma to do my makeup, okay?" Maria said, bounding up to me, her 14-year-old body still cultish and awkward. "Why?" I said. "'Cause I want her to. She said if it was okay with you, she would." I looked at Catherine. She shrugged. Maria Rabbit punched me in the arm. "Please, please, 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 please." I've spoken enough about how bleak my life felt after baseball. I should mention that Maria was the exception to all that. I found my greatest joy in her. I tried to be a decent father. I tried to pay attention to the little things. I wiped the ketchup off her face after French fries. I sat beside her at her small desk, pencil in hand, helping her to do math problems. I sent her back upstairs when, as an 11-year-old, she came down wearing a halter top, and I was always quick to throw her a ball or take her to the local YMCA for swimming lessons, happy to keep her a tomboy as long as possible. I would later learn, after I fell out of her life, that she wrote about sports for her college newspaper. And in that mixing of words and athletics, I realized how your mother and father pass through you to your children, like it or not. As the party continued, plates clanked and music played. The room hummed with chatter. My mother read her cards out loud as if they were congratulatory telegrams from foreign dignitaries. even the cheap pastel-colored ones with rabbits on the front. "Just thought I'd hop in to say, hope your birthday is a real thumper." When she finished, she would turn the card open so everyone could see, and she'd blow a kiss to the sender. Mwah! Sometime after the cards, but before the cake and gifts, the phone rang. The phone could ring a long time in my mother's house, because she wouldn't rush what she was doing to answer. She would finish vacuuming the last corner or spraying the last window, as if it didn't count until you picked it up. Since nobody was getting it, I did. If I had my life to do over again, I would have let it ring. "Hello?" I yelled over the din. My mother still used a princess phone. The cord was 20 feet long because she liked to walk around as she talked. "Hello?" I said again. I pressed the receiver closer to my ear. "Hello?" I was about to hang up when I heard a man clear his throat. Then my father said, "Chick, that you?" At first I didn't answer. I was stunned. Although my mother's phone number had never changed, it was hard to believe my father was calling it. His departure from this house had been so sudden and destructive, hearing his voice seemed like a man walking back into a burning building. "Yeah, it's me," I whispered. "I've been trying to find you. I called your house and your office. I took a chance you might be..." "It's Mom's birthday." "Oh, right," he said. "Did you want to speak to her?" I had rushed into that sentence. I could feel my father rolling his eyes. "Chick, I was talking with Pete Garner." "Pete Garner, from the Pirates?" "Yeah?" I walked the phone away from the guests. As I cupped the receiver with my free hand, I glanced at two old women sitting on the couch, eating tuna salad from paper plates. "They got their old-timers game, right?" my father said. "And Pete tells me Freddy Gonzalez bailed out, some crap with his paperwork. I don't get why. It's too late for them to make calls for replacement. So I say to Pete, hey, Chick's around." "Dad, I'm not around." "You can be. He don't know where you're at." "An old-timers game?" So he says, "Oh, yeah, Chick is?" And I say, "Yeah, in good shape, too, Dad." And so Pete says, "Dad." I knew where this was going. I knew it immediately. The only person who had a harder time giving up my baseball career than me was my father. "Pete says they'll put you on the roster. All you's got to do is..." "Dad, I only play..." "Get up here. 6 weeks in the majors, around 10 a.m. I only play..." "And then you can't do an old-timers game with..." "What's your problem, Chick?" I hate that question. What's your problem? There's no good answer except, I don't have a problem. Which clearly was not true. I sighed. "They said they put me on the roster?" "That's what I'm saying." "To play? Are you deaf? That's what I'm saying." "And this is when?" "Tomorrow. The guys from the organization will be there and..." "Tomorrow? Dad, tomorrow what?" "It's like 3 o'clock already. You're in the dugout, you bump into these guys, you strike up a conversation." "I bump into who?" "Whoever. Anderson, Molina, Mike Junez, the trainer, the bald guy. You make it a goddamn point to bump into them. You get to talking, you never know." "What?" "Something opens up. A coaching spot, a batting instructor, something in the minors. You get a foot in the door." "Why would they want me?" "That's how these things..." "I haven't swung a bat and happen. That's how they happen, Chick. You get a foot in the door." "But it's who you know when these jobs open." "Dad, I have a job." A pause. My father could hurt you more with a pause than any man I've ever known. "Look," he said, exhaling. "I finagled an opening. You want this or not?" His voice had shifted, the fighter angering, bawling his fists. He had dismissed my current existence as swiftly as I wished I could. It made me recoil, and in recoiling, of course, a fight is lost. "Just get your butt out here, okay?" he said. "It's Mom's birthday." "Not tomorrow, it ain't." Looking back on that conversation, there are many things I wish I'd asked. Did he give a hoot that his ex-wife was having a birthday? Did he want to know how she was feeling? Who was there? What the house looked like? If she ever thought of him? Fondly, badly, at all? There are a lot of things I wish I'd asked him. Instead, I said I'd call him back. I hung up the phone. And I let the opportunity my father had finagled dance around my head. I thought about it as my mother sliced her vanilla layer cake and put each piece on a paper plate. I thought about it as she opened her presents. I thought about it as Catherine, Maria, and I posed around her for a photo, Maria now covered in purple eyeshadow. And my mom's friend Edith held up the camera and said, 1, 2... Ugh, wait, this thing, I can never figure it out. And even as we stood there, forcing our smiles, I was picturing my swing. I tried to focus. I tried to wrap my mother's birthday party around me, but my father, a thief in many ways, had robbed me of my concentration. Before the paper plates were tossed, I was down in the basement, on the phone, booking the last plane out. My mother used to start her sentences with, "Be a good boy," as in, "Be a good boy and take out the garbage," or "Be a good boy and run to the store." But with one phone call, the good boy I had been when I arrived that day had taken a powder, and another boy had taken his place. I had to lie to everyone there. It wasn't hard. I wore a pager for work, and I called it from the downstairs phone, then went upstairs quickly. When the pager went off in front of Catherine, I acted annoyed, grumbling about them bothering me on a Saturday. I faked the return phone call, faked my dismay, faked a story about having to fly to a client who would only do the meeting on a Sunday, and wasn't it awful? "They can't wait?" my mother asked. "I know, it's ridiculous," I said. "But we're having brunch tomorrow." "Look, what do you want me to do?" "You can't call them back?" "No, Mom," I snapped. "I can't call them back." She looked down. I exhaled in exasperation. The more you defend a lie, the angrier you become. An hour later, a cab pulled up. I grabbed my bag. I hugged Catherine and Maria, who forced smiles that were really half frowns. I yelled a goodbye into the gathering. The group yelled back, "So long, bye, good luck." I heard my mother's voice last, above the others. "Love you, Char." The door shut mid-sentence, and I never saw her again. Times my mother stood up for me. "But what do you know about running a restaurant?" my wife says. "It's a sports bar," I say. We are sitting at our dining room table. My mother is there as well, playing peekaboo with little Maria. This is after I've quit baseball. A friend wants me to partner in a new business. "But isn't it hard to run a bar?" Catherine says. "Aren't there things you have to know about?" "He knows that stuff," I say. "What do you think, Mom?" Catherine asks. My mother takes Maria's hands and flops them up and down. "Would you have to work nights, Charlie?" she asks. "What? Nights? Would you have to work nights?" "I'm the investor, Mom. I'm not going to wait tables." "It's a lot of money," Catherine says. "If you don't invest money, you can't make money," I say. "Isn't there something besides this?" Catherine says. I exhale loudly. "In truth, I don't know what there is. When you play sports, you train yourself not to think too much about anything else. I can't imagine myself behind a desk. This is a bar. I know about bars. I have already begun a reliance on alcohol as part of my daily existence, and secretly there is appeal in having it so handy. Plus, the place has the word sports in it." "Where is it?" my mother asks. "About a half hour from here." "How often would you have to go?" "I don't know. But not at night." "Why do you keep asking about nights?" She wiggles her finger in Maria's face. "You have a daughter, Charlie." I shake my head. "I know, Mom, okay?" Catherine rises. She clears the dishes. "It scares me, that's all. I'm just being honest." I slump. I stare down. When I look up, my mother is watching me. She puts a finger under her chin and lifts it slightly, telling me in her way that I should do the same. "You know what I think?" she announces. "I think you have to try things in life. Is this something you believe in, Charlie?" I nod yes. "Belief, hard work, love, you have those things, you can do anything." I sit up. My wife shrugs. The mood has changed. The odds have improved. A few months later, the sports bar opens. 2 years later, it goes out of business. Apparently, you need more than those three things, at least in my world, if not hers. The game. I stayed in a Best Western hotel the night before the old-timers game, which reminded me of my playing days and the road trips we took. I couldn't sleep. I wondered how many people would be in the ballpark. I wondered if I could even make contact with a pitch. At 5:30 a.m., I got out of bed to try some stretching. The red light on my phone was blinking. I called the front desk. It rang at least 20 times. "I have a message light on," I said, when someone finally answered. "One sec," the voice groaned. "Yeah, there's a package for you." I went downstairs. The clerk handed me an old shoebox. It had my name taped on top. He yawned. I opened it. My cleats. Apparently, my father had kept them all these years. He must have dropped them off sometime during the night, without even phoning the room. I looked for a note, but there was nothing else in the box, just my shoes with all their old scrapes. I arrived at the ballpark early. I had the cab drop me off out of habit near the players' entrance, but the guard directed me to the employee gate, where the beer and hot dog vendors enter. The stadium was empty and the hall smelled of sausage grease. It was strange returning to this place. I had wanted for so many years to earn my way back as a player. Now I was part of a promotion, Old Timers Day, a few innings of free nostalgia, a way to sell tickets, like Cap Day or Ball Day or Fireworks Day. I found my way to an auxiliary locker room where we were supposed to dress. An attendant at the door checked my name off a list and gave me my uniform for the day. "Where can I—" "Any place over there," he motioned, pointing to a row of metal lockers, grease paint blue. Two white-haired guys were talking in the corner. They gave me a chin nod without stopping their conversation. It felt awkward, like going to a high school reunion for someone else's class. Then again, I'd had 6 weeks in the major leagues. It wasn't like I made lifelong friends. My uniform had Bonetto stitched across the back, although upon careful inspection I could see the fabric shading from an old name that had been there before. I pulled the top over my head. I wiggled my arms through the sleeves. When I tugged it down, I turned, and Willie Bomber Jackson was standing a few feet away. Everyone knew Jackson. He was a terrific hitter, famous for both his power and his cockiness at the plate. Once, during the playoffs, he pointed his bat to the right field fence, calling his shot, and then delivered with a towering home run. You only have to do this once in your career to be immortalized, what with the replays they have on TV. And he was. Now he sat on a stool next to me. I had never played with Jackson. He was pudgy, almost inflated-looking in his blue velour sweatsuit, but there was still something regal about him. He nodded at me, and I nodded back. "What's up?" he said. "Chick Bonetto," I said, offering my hand. He grabbed the inner fingers and yanked them. He never said his name. It was understood he didn't have to. "So, Chuck, what are you doing these days?" I didn't correct his pronunciation. I said I was in marketing. "And you?" I asked. "Still broadcasting?" "Little bit. Mostly investments now." I nodded. "Cool, yeah, good move, investments." "Mutual funds," he said. "Some shelters, unit trusts, stuff like that. Mostly mutuals." I nodded again. I felt stupid for already wearing my uniform. "You into the market?" he said. I flipped my palm. "You know, here and there." That was a lie. I was neither here nor there in the market. He studied me, moving his jaw. "Well, look it. I can hook you up." For a moment there was something to this, the famous Jackson willing to hook me up. And I began in my mind to come up with money I did not have. But as he reached in his pocket, presumably for a business card, someone yelled, "Jackson, you fat fart!" We both spun, and there was Buck Alexander, and he and Jackson embraced so hard they almost tumbled into me. I had to step out of the way. A minute later, they were across the room, surrounded by others. And that was it for my time in mutual funds. The old-timers game was played an hour before the real game, which meant the stands were mostly empty when we began. An organ sounded. The PA announcer welcomed the sparse crowd. We were introduced alphabetically, beginning with an outfielder named Rusty Allenback, who played in the late 1940s, followed by Benny Bobo Barbosa, a popular infielder from the 1960s, with one of those huge, wide grins. He ran out waving. The fans were still clapping for him when my name was called. The announcer said, "From the pennant-winning team of 1973, and you could hear a tingle of anticipation. And then, "Catcher Charles Chick Bonetto." And there was a sudden drop in volume, enthusiasm melting to politeness. I darted out of the dugout and almost ran up Barbosa's legs. I was trying to take my place before the applause died, to avoid that embarrassing silence where you can hear your own feet on the gravelly sand. Somewhere in that crowd was my old man, although when I pictured him, his arms were crossed. No clapping from the home team. And then the game itself. It was like a train station in the dugout, guys shuffling in and out, grabbing bats, bumping around each other as their cleats rang on the concrete floor. I had one inning catching, which was plenty, because squatting down after all those years had my thighs burning as early as the third pitch. I kept shifting my weight from foot to foot until one batter, a tall, hairy-armed guy named Teddy Slaughter, said, "Hey, pal, You want to stop hopping around back there? To the arriving crowd, I suppose it looked like baseball. 8 fielders, 1 pitcher, 1 batter, 1 umpire dressed in black. But we were far from the fluid, powerful dance of our younger days. We were slow now, clunky. Our swings were leaden, and our throws were high and loping, too much air beneath them. In our dugout, there were big-bellied men who had clearly surrendered to the aging process and who cracked jokes like, "Jesus, somebody get me some oxygen." And then there were guys who still held to the code of taking all games seriously. I sat next to an old Puerto Rican outfielder, he had to be at least 60, who kept spitting tobacco juice on the floor and mumbling, "Here we go, babies, here we go." When I finally came to bat, the stadium was less than half full. I took a few practice swings and then stepped into the batter's box. The sun went behind a cloud. I heard a vendor yell. I felt perspiration on my neck. I shifted on my feet. And even though I had done this a million times in my life, gripped the bat handle, raised my shoulders, set my jaw, narrowed my gaze, my heart was racing. I think I just wanted to survive for more than a few seconds. The first pitch came in. I let it go. The umpire called, "Ball one!" And I wanted to thank him. Do you ever think while something is happening about what's happening someplace else? My mother, after the divorce, would stand on the back porch at sunset smoking a cigarette, and she'd say, "Charlie, right now, as the sun is going down here, it's coming up someplace else in the world, Australia or China or someplace. You can look it up in the encyclopedia." She'd blow smoke and stare down the row of square backyards with their laundry poles and swing sets. "It's such a big world," she'd say wistfully. "Something is always happening somewhere." She was right about that. Something is always happening somewhere. So when I stood at the plate in that old-timers game, staring at a pitcher whose hair was gray, and when he threw what used to be his fastball but was now just a pitch that floated in toward my chest, and when I swung and made contact and heard the familiar thwack, and I dropped my bat and began to run, convinced that I had done something fabulous, forgetting my old gauges, forgetting that my arms and legs lack the power they once had, forgetting that as you age, the walls get further away. And when I looked up and saw what I had first thought to be a solid hit, maybe a home run, now coming down just beyond the infield toward the waiting glove of the second baseman, no more than a pop-up, a wet firecracker, a dud, and a voice in my head yelled, "Drop it, drop it," as that second baseman squeezed his glove around my final offering to this maddening game. Just as all that was happening, my mother, as she once noted, had something else happening back in Pepperville Beach. Her clock radio was playing big band music. Her pillows had been freshly plumped, and her body was crumpled like a broken doll on the floor of her bedroom, where she had come looking for her new red glasses and collapsed. A massive heart attack. She was taking her last breaths. When the old-timers game was finished, we walked back down the tunnel, passing the current players walking out. We took each other's measure. They were young and smooth-skinned. We were fat and balding. I nodded at a muscular guy carrying a catcher's mask. It was like watching myself going out as I was coming in. Inside the locker room, I packed up quickly. Some of us took showers, but it seemed silly. We hadn't really worked that hard. I folded my uniform top and kept it as a souvenir. I zipped my bag shut. I sat for a few minutes, fully dressed. Then there didn't seem to be much point. I exited the way I'd come in, through the employee's entrance, and there was my father, smoking a cigarette and looking up at the sky. He seemed surprised to see me. "Thanks for the cleats," I said, holding them up. "What are you doing out here?" he said, annoyed. "Can't you find someone to talk to in there?" I spurted out a sarcastic breath. "I don't know, Dad. I guess I just came out to say hello. I haven't seen you in like 2 years. "Jesus," he shook his head in disgust. "How are you going to get back in the game talking to me?" Chick finds out his mom is gone. "Hello?" My wife's voice sounded shaky, disturbed. "Hey, it's me," I said. "Sorry. Oh, Chick, oh God, we didn't know where to reach you." I had been ready with my lies, the client, the meeting, all of it. But they fell now like bricks. "What's the matter?" I said. "Your mom. Oh my God, Chick, where were you? We didn't..." "What? What?" She started crying, gasping. "Tell me," I said. "What?" "It was a heart attack. Maria found her." "What? Your mom. She died." I hope you never hear those words. Your mom, she died. They're different than other words. They're too big to fit in your ears. They belong to some strange, heavy, powerful language that pounds away at the side of your head, a wrecking ball coming at you again and again, until finally the words crack a hole large enough to fit inside your brain. And in so doing, they split you apart. Where? I said.
At the house.
Where? I mean, when? Suddenly, details seemed extremely important. Details were something to grab onto, a way to insert myself into the story. How did she...
Chick, Catherine said softly. Just come home, okay?
I rented a car. I drove through the night. I drove with my shock and grief in the back seat and my guilt in the front. I reached Pepperville Beach just before sunrise. I pulled into the driveway. I shut the engine. The sky was a rotted purple. My car smelled of beer. As I sat there, watching the dawn rise around me, I realized I hadn't called my father to tell him of my mother's death. And with that sick thought, I burst into tears. A third and final visit. My mother and I walked now through a town I had never seen. It was unremarkable, a gas station on one corner, a small convenience store on the other. The telephone poles and the bark of the trees were the same cardboard color, and most of the trees had dropped their leaves. We stopped in front of a two-story apartment building. It was pale yellow brick. Where are we? I said. My mother checked the horizon. The sun had already set.
You should have had more dinner, she said.
I rolled my eyes. Come on.
What?
She grinned. I like knowing you've eaten. You have to take care of yourself, Charlie. I saw in her expression that old, unshakable mountain of concern, and I realized that when you look at your mother, you are looking at the purest love you will ever know. I wish we'd done this before, Mom, you know?
You mean before I died?
My voice went timid.
Yeah.
I was here.
I know.
You were busy. I shuddered at that word. It seemed so hollow now. I saw a wave of resignation pass over her face. I believe, at that moment, we were both thinking how things might be different if we did them over.
Charlie, she asked, was I a good mother?
I opened my mouth to speak, but a blinding flash erased her from sight. I felt heat on my face, as if the sun were baking down on it. Then once again, that booming voice. Charles Bonetto, open your eyes! I blinked hard. Suddenly, I was blocks behind my mother, as if she'd kept walking and I'd stopped. I blinked again. She was even farther ahead. I could barely see her anymore. I stretched forward, my fingers straining, my shoulders pulling from their sockets. Everything was spinning. I felt myself trying to call her name, the word vibrating in my throat. It took all the strength I had. And then she was with me again, taking my hand, all calm, as if nothing had happened. We glided back to where we'd been.
One more stop, she repeated.
She turned me toward the pale yellow building, and instantly we were inside it, a low-ceilinged apartment heavily furnished. The bedroom was small. The wallpaper was avocado green. A painting of vineyards hung on the wall, and a cross was over the bed. In the corner there was a champagne wooden dressing table beneath a large mirror, and before that mirror sat a dark-haired woman wearing a bathrobe the color of pink grapefruit. She appeared to be in her 70s, with a long, narrow nose and prominent cheekbones beneath her sagging olive skin. She ran a brush through her hair, slowly, absently, looking down at the counter. My mother stepped up behind her. There was no greeting. Instead, she put her hands out, and they melted into the hands of the woman, one holding the brush, the other following the strokes with a flattening palm. The woman glanced up, as if checking her reflection in the mirror, but her eyes were smoky and far away. I think she was seeing my mother. Neither said a word.
Mom,
I finally whispered.
Who is she?
My mother turned, her hands in the woman's hair. She's your father's wife. Times I did not stand up for my mother. Take the shovel, the minister said. He said it with his eyes. I was to toss dirt onto my mother's coffin, which was half lowered into the grave. My mother, the minister explained, had witnessed this custom at Jewish funerals and had requested it for her own. She felt it helped mourners accept that the body was gone, and they should remember the spirit. I could hear my father chiding her, saying, "Posy, I swear, you make it up as you go along." I took the shovel like a child being handed a rifle. I looked to my sister, Roberta, who wore a black veil over her face and was visibly trembling. I looked to my wife, who was staring at her feet, tears streaming down her cheeks, her right hand rhythmically smoothing our daughter's hair. Only Maria looked at me, and her eyes seemed to say, "Don't do it, Dad. Give it back." In baseball, a player can tell when he's holding his own bat and when he's holding someone else's, which is how I felt with that shovel in my hands. It was someone else's. It did not belong to me. It belonged to a son who didn't lie to his mother. It belonged to a son whose last words to her were not in anger. It belonged to a son who hadn't raced off to satisfy the latest whim of his distant old man, who, in keeping the record intact, was absent from this family gathering, having decided, "It's better if I'm not there. I don't want to upset anybody." That son would have stayed that weekend, sleeping with his wife in the guest room, having Sunday brunch with the family. That son would have been there when his mother collapsed. That son might have saved her. But that son was not around. This son swallowed and did what he was told. He shoveled dirt onto the coffin. It landed with a messy spread, a few gravelly pieces making noise against the polished wood. And even though it was her idea, I heard my mother's voice saying, "Oh, Charlie, how could you?" Everything explained. She's your father's wife. How can I explain that sentence? I can't. I can only tell you what my mother's spirit told me, standing in that strange apartment with a painting of vineyards on the wall. She's your father's wife. They met during the war. Your father was stationed in Italy. He told you that, right? Many times. Italy, late 1944. The Apennine Mountains and the Po Valley, not far from Bologna. She lived in a village there, my mother said. She was poor. He was a soldier. You know how those things go. Your father in those days was very, I don't know, what's the word? Bold? My mother looked at her hands as they brushed out the woman's hair. Do you think she's pretty, Charlie? I always figured she was. She still is, even now, don't you think? My head was spinning. What do you mean, his wife? You were his wife. She nodded slowly. Yes, I was. You can't have two wives. No, she whispered. You're right. You can't. The woman sniffed. Her eyes looked red and tired. She didn't acknowledge me, but she seemed to be listening as my mother spoke. I think your father got scared during the war, my mother said. He didn't know how long it would last. A lot of men were killed in those mountains. Maybe she gave him security. Maybe he thought he'd never get home. Who knows? He always needed a plan, your father. He said that a lot. Have a plan. Have a plan. I don't understand, I said. Dad wrote you that letter. Yes. He proposed. You accepted. She sighed. When he realized the war was ending, I guess he wanted a different plan. His old plan with me. Things change when you're not in danger anymore, Charlie. And so, she lifted the woman's hair from her shoulders. He left her behind. She paused. Your father had a knack for that. I shook my head. But why did you? He never told me, Charlie. He never told anyone. But at some point over the years, he found her again, or she found him, and eventually he brought her to America. He set up a whole other life. He even bought a second house in Collingswood, where he built his new store, remember? The woman put the brush down. My mother's hands withdrew, and she hooked them together now, bringing them under her chin. It was her ziti your father wanted me to make all those years. She exhaled. For some reason, that still bugs me. And then she told me the rest of the story, how she discovered all this, how she asked once why they never got a bill from the hotel in Collingswood, how he said he was paying cash, which made her suspicious, how she arranged for a babysitter one Friday night, then drove nervously to Collingswood herself, going up and down the streets, until she saw his Buick in the driveway of a strange house, and she burst into tears.
I was shaking, Charlie, she said. I had to force every step. I snuck down to a window and looked inside. They were eating dinner. Your father had his shirt unbuttoned, his undershirt showing, like he always did with us. He was sitting with his food, no hurry, relaxed, as if he lived there, passing the dishes to this woman and... She stopped. Are you sure you want to know this? I nodded blankly. Their son. What? I said. He was a few years older than you. A boy? My voice squeaked as I said that. I'm sorry, Charlie. I felt dizzy as if falling backward. Even telling you now, I have trouble getting the words out. My father, who had demanded my devotion, my loyalty to his team, the men in our family. He had another son? Did he play baseball? I whispered. My mother looked at me helplessly. Charlie, she said, almost crying, I really don't know. The woman in the bathrobe opened a small drawer. She took out some papers and flipped through them. Was she really who my mother said she was? She looked Italian. She seemed the right age. I tried to picture my father meeting her. I tried to picture them together. I didn't know a thing about this woman or this apartment, but I felt my old man all over the room. I drove home that night, Charlie, my mother said, and I sat on the curb. I waited. I didn't even want him pulling into our driveway. He came back after midnight, and I'll never forget the look on his face when the headlights hit me, because in that moment I think he knew he'd been found out. I got into the car and I made him roll up all the windows. I didn't want anyone hearing me. And then I exploded. I exploded in such a way that he couldn't use any of his lies. He finally admitted who she was, where they had met, what he'd been trying to do. My head was spinning. My stomach hurt so badly I couldn't sit up straight. You expect a lot of things in a marriage, Charlie, but who could see themselves replaced like that? She turned to the wall, her gaze falling on the painting of the vineyards. I'm not sure it really hit me until months later. Inside that car, I was just furious and heartbroken. He swore he was sorry. He swore he didn't know about this other son, that when he found out, he felt obligated to do something. I don't know what was true and what wasn't. Even screaming, your father had an answer for everything. But none of it mattered. It was over, don't you see? I could have forgiven him almost anything against me. But that was a betrayal of you and your sister, too. She turned to me. You have one family, Charlie. For good or bad, you have one family. You can't trade them in. You can't lie to them. You can't run two at once, substituting back and forth. Sticking with your family is what makes it a family. She sighed. So I had to make a decision. I tried to picture that awful moment, in a car, after midnight, with the windows rolled up, from the outside two figures silently screaming. I tried to picture how our family slept in one house, while another family slept in another, and both had my father's clothes hanging in the closet. I tried to picture charming Posey of Pepperville Beach, losing her old life that night, crying and screaming as it all collapsed in front of her. And I realized that, on the list of times my mother stood up for me, this would have to go at the top. Mom, I finally whispered. What did you tell him? She exhaled. I told him to leave and to never come back. So now I knew what happened the night before the corn puffs. There are many things in my life that I wish I could take back. Many moments I would recast. But the one I would change if I could change just one would not be for me, but for my daughter, Maria, who came looking for her grandmother that Sunday afternoon and found her sprawled on the bedroom floor. She tried to wake her. She started screaming. She raced in and out of the room, torn between yelling for help and not leaving her alone. That never should have happened. She was only a kid. I think from that point on, it was hard for me to face my daughter or my wife. I think that's why I drank so much. I think that's why I whimpered off into another life, because deep down I didn't feel that I deserved the old one anymore. I ran away. In that manner, I suppose my father and I were sadly parallel. When 2 weeks later, in the quiet of our bedroom, I confessed to Catherine where I had been, that there was no business trip, that that I was playing baseball in a Pittsburgh stadium while my mother lay dying. She was more numb than anything else. She kept looking at me as if she wanted to say something that she never ended up saying. In the end, her only comment was, "At this point, what does it matter?" My mother crossed the small bedroom and stood by the only window. She moved the curtains aside. "It's dark out," she said. Behind us at the mirror, the Italian woman looked down, fingering her papers. "Mom," I said, "do you hate her?" She shook her head. "Why should I hate her? She only wanted the same things I did. She didn't get them either. Their marriage ended. Your father moved on. Like I said, he had a knack for that." She grabbed her elbows as if she were cold. The woman at the mirror put her face in her hands. She let out a small sob. "Secrets, Charlie," my mother whispered. "They'll tear you apart." We all three hung there silently for a minute, each in our own world. Then my mother turned to me. "You have to go now," she said. "Go?" My voice choked. "Where? Why?" "But Charlie," she took my hands, "I want to ask you something first." Her eyes were wet with tears. "Why do you want to die?" I shivered. For a second, I couldn't breathe. "You knew?" She gave a sad smile. "I'm your mother." My body convulsed. I spit out a gush of air. "Mom, I'm not who you think. I messed things up. I drank. I blew everything. I lost my family." "No, Charlie." "Yes, yes, I did." My voice was shaking. "I fell apart. Catherine's gone, Mom. I drove her away. Maria, I'm not even in her life. She's married. I wasn't even there. I'm an outsider now. I'm an outsider to everything I loved." My chest was heaving. "And you, that last day, I never should have left you. I could never tell you." My head lowered in shame. "How sorry. How I'm so. That was all I got out. I fell to the floor, sobbing uncontrollably, emptying myself, wailing. The room shrunk to a heap behind my eyes. I don't know how long I was like that. When I found my voice, it was barely a rasp. "I wanted it to stop, Mom. This anger, this guilt. That's why I wanted to die." I lifted my eyes and for the first time admitted the truth. "I gave up," I whispered. "Don't give up," she whispered back. I buried my head then. I'm not ashamed to say it. I buried my head in my mother's arms, and her hands cradled my neck. We held each other like that just briefly, but I cannot put into words the comfort I drew from that moment. I can only say, as I speak to you now, I still yearn for it. "I wasn't there when you died, Mom." "You had something to do," she said. "I lied. It was the worst lie I ever told. It wasn't work. I went to play in a game. A stupid game. I was so desperate to please your father." She nodded gently, and I realized she had known all along. Across the room, the Italian woman pulled her bathrobe tighter. She clasped her hands as if in prayer. Such a strange trio we made, each of us at some point longing to be loved by the same man. I could still hear his words forcing my decision. "Mama's boy or daddy's boy, chick? What's it gonna be?" "I made the wrong choice," I whispered. My mother shook her head. "A child should never have to choose." The Italian woman stood up now. She wiped her eyes and collected herself. She placed her fingers on the edge of the dressing table and pushed two items close together. My mother motioned me forward until I could see what she had been looking at. One was a photo of a young man in a graduation cap. I assume it was her son. The other was my baseball card. She flicked her eyes up to the mirror and caught our reflections, the three of us, framed like a bizarre family portrait. For the first and only moment, I was certain she saw me. "Perdonare," the woman mumbled, and everything around us disappeared. Chick finishes his story. Have you ever isolated your earliest childhood memory? Mine is when I was 3 years old. It was summer,
a carnival in the park near our house. There were balloons and cotton candy stands. A bunch of guys who had just finished a tug of war were lined up at the water fountain. I must have been thirsty, because my mother lifted me by my armpits and carried me to the front of that line. And I remember how she cut in front of all those sweaty, shirtless men, how she squeezed one arm tight around my chest and used her free hand to turn the handle. She whispered in my ear, "Drink the water, Charlie." And I bent forward, my feet dangling above the ground, and I slurped it up, and all those men just waited for us to finish. I can still feel her arm around me. I can still see the bubbling water. That is my earliest memory, mother and son, a world unto ourselves. Now, at the end of this last day together, the same thing was happening. My body felt broken. I could barely make it move. But her arm went across my chest, and I sensed her carrying me once more, air passing over my face. I saw only darkness, as if we were traveling behind the length of a curtain. Then the dark pulled away, and there were stars, thousands of them. She was laying me down in wet grass, returning my ruined soul to this world. "Mom," my throat was raw, I had to swallow between words. "That woman, what was she saying?" She gently lowered my shoulders. "Forgive." "Forgive her, Dad?" My head touched the earth. I felt moist blood trickling down my temples. "Yourself," she said. My body was locking up. I couldn't move my arms or my legs. I was slipping away. How much time did I have left? "Yes," I rasped. She looked confused. "Yes, you are a good mother." She touched her mouth to hide a grin, and she seemed to fill to bursting. "Live," she said. "No, wait. I love you, Charlie." She waved her fingertips. I was crying. "I'll lose you." Her face seemed to float over mine. "You can't lose your mother, Charlie. I'm right here." Then a huge flash of light obliterated her image. "Charles Bonetto, can you hear me?" I felt a tingling in my limbs. "We're going to move you now." I wanted to pull her back. "Are you with us, Charles?" "Me and my mother," I mumbled. I felt a soft kiss on my forehead. "My mother and I," she corrected. And she was gone. I blinked hard. I saw the sky. I saw the stars. Then the stars began to fall. They grew larger as they grew closer, round and white, like baseballs. And I instinctively opened my palms as if widening my glove to catch them all. "Wait, look at his hands!" The voice softened. "Charles?" Even softer. "Charles, hey, there you go, fella. Come back to us." "Yo, guys!" He waved his flashlight at two other police officers. He was young, just as I had thought. Chick's final thoughts. Now, as I said when you first sat down, I don't expect you to go with me here. I haven't told this story before, but I had hoped to. I waited for this chance. And I'm glad it's come now that it's done. I've forgotten so many things in my life, yet I can remember every moment of that time with my mother, the people we saw, the things we discussed. It was so ordinary in so many ways, but as she said, you can find something truly important in an ordinary minute. You may think me crazy that I imagined the whole thing, but I believe this in the deepest part of my soul. My mother, somewhere between this world and the next, gave me one more day, the day I'd wanted so badly, and she told me all that I've told you. And if my mother said it, I believe it. "What causes an echo?" she once quizzed me. "The persistence of sound after the source has stopped." "When can you hear an echo?" "When it's quiet and other sounds are absorbed." "When it's quiet, when I am quiet, her sound persists. And I can hear my mother's echo still." I feel ashamed now that I tried to take my life. It is such a precious thing. I had no one to talk me out of my despair, and that was a mistake. You need to keep people close. You need to give them access to your heart. As for what's happened in the 2 years since, there are so many details. The hospital stay, the treatment I received, where I've been. Let's just say for now that I was lucky on many levels. I'm alive. I didn't kill anyone. I've been sober every day since, although some days are harder than others.
I've thought a lot about that night. I believe my mother saved my life. I also believe that parents, if they love you, will hold you up safely above their swirling waters, and sometimes that means you'll never know what they endured, and you may treat them unkindly in a way you otherwise wouldn't. But there's a story behind everything, how a picture got on a wall, how a scar got on your face. Sometimes the stories are simple, and sometimes they are hard and heartbreaking. But behind all your stories is always your mother's story, because hers is where yours begins. So this was my mother's story, and mine. I would like to make things right again with those I love. Epilogue. Charles Chick Bonetto died last month, 5 years after his attempted suicide, and 3 years after our encounter on that Saturday morning. The funeral was small, only a few family members, including his ex-wife and several friends from his childhood in Pepperville Beach, who recalled climbing a water tower with Chick and spray-painting their names on the tank. No one from his baseball days was on hand, although the Pittsburgh Pirates sent a condolence card. His father was there. He stood in the back of the church, a slim man with stooped shoulders and thin white hair. He wore a brown suit and sunglasses and left quickly after the service. The cause of Chick's death was a sudden stroke, an embolism that went to his brain and killed him almost instantly. Doctors speculate that his blood vessels may have weakened from the head trauma of his car crash. He was 58 when he died. Too young, everyone agreed. As for the details of his story, in putting this account together, I checked into nearly all of them. There was indeed an accident on the highway entrance ramp that night, and a car, after clipping the front end of a moving van, went over an embankment, destroyed a billboard, and ejected its driver into the grass. There was indeed a widow named Rose Templeton, who lived on Lehigh Street in Pepperville Beach, and died shortly after the accident. There was also a Miss Thelma Bradley, who died not long after, and whose obituary in the local newspaper identified her as a retired housekeeper. A marriage certificate was filed in 1962, a year after the Bonettos divorced, for a Leonard Bonetto and a Gianna Tosici, confirming an earlier marriage in Italy. A Leo Tosici, presumably their son, was listed as a student at Collingswood High School in the early 1960s. There were no other records for him. As for Pauline Posey Bonetto, she died of a heart attack at age 79, and the details of her life match the accounts given in these pages. Her humor, warmth, and motherly wisdom were attested to by her surviving family. Her photo still hangs at the beauty parlor where she worked. In it, she is wearing a blue smock and hoop earrings. Chick Bonetto's final years seemed to bring him some contentment. He sold his mother's home in Pepperville Beach and directed the proceeds to his daughter. He later moved to an apartment to be near her, and they reestablished a relationship, including Saturday morning donut runs, in which they caught up on events of the week over coffee and crullers. Although he never fully reconciled with Catherine Bonetto, they made their peace and spoke regularly. His salesman days were over, but until his death, Chick worked part-time with the local Parks and Recreation office, where he had one rule for the organized games: everyone gets to play. A week before his stroke, he seemed to sense that his time was short. He told those around him, "Remember me for these days, not the old ones." He was buried in a plot near his mother. Because there was a ghost involved, you may call this a ghost story. But what family isn't a ghost story? Sharing tales of those we've lost is how we keep from really losing them. And even though Chick is gone now, his story flows through others. It flows through me. I don't think he was crazy. I think he really did get one more day with his mother. And one day spent with someone you love can change everything. I know. I had a day like that too, in the bleachers of a Little League field. A day to listen, to love, to apologize, to forgive, and to decide, years later, that this baby boy I'm carrying will soon be called, proudly, Charlie. My married name is Maria Lang, but before that, I was Maria Bonetto. Chick Bonetto was my father. And if my father said it, I believe it.
This has been a Hyperion Audiobooks production of For One More Day, written and read by Mitch Albom. Directed and produced by Kevin Thompson. Recorded at Harmony Park Studios in Detroit, Michigan. Post-production by Pete Pantelis. Production supervised by Linda Ross Korn. For One More Day is also available in print from Hyperion. Text copyright 2006 by Mitch Albom Incorporated. All rights reserved. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.